Hello everyone, and welcome to Cure Talks for a discussion on multiple myeloma. I'm Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor at Cure Talks, joining you from India, and I welcome all of you this evening. This is Cure Talks' 73rd episode. We are excited to inform our audience that henceforth we will be conducting our shows under the name of Cure Talks, and we have a new website, curetalks.com. The website is a work in progress, and we would really love some feedback from you. Please do check it out and mail me, priya@trilix.com, with your feedback. On our myeloma broadcast today, we are discussing more can cure myeloma treatment. My co-host for the show is myeloma survivor and editor of MyelomaSurvival.com, Gary Peterson. On the panel are myeloma advocates and survivors, Pat Killingsworth, Nick Van Dyke, and Cynthia Schmilewitzke. We have a very distinguished guest with us today, Dr. Gareth Morgan, Director of the Myeloma Institute for Research and Therapy at UAMS. Welcome to the show, Dr. Morgan. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you, Priya. It's a pleasure to be here with you and with the audience. So hopefully I can be informative and we can have a good discussion.
Gary Peterson will introduce us to our expert and begin with the discussion. Before I hand over to Gary, I would like to tell all listeners that we will be addressing questions towards the end of the show. And if you want to ask a question to our panel, you can press 1 on your keypad and we will bring you on air to ask your question. Alternately, you can email me with your question at priya@trilix.com. With that, it's over to Gary. Gary, you're on air.
All right, thank you again, Priya, and thank you for bringing us this forum and for updating it for a better user experience in the future. So we all thank you that, thank you for that, and thank you for all that you do for the myeloma patient community. I have the pleasure of introducing Dr. Gareth Morgan, MD, PhD, FRCP, and FRCPath. Somebody I think has more initials than anybody I've ever introduced in the past. Gareth Morgan is professor of medicine and pathology and the director of the Myeloma Institute for Research and Therapy at the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences. He is also the deputy director of the Winthrop P. Rockefeller Cancer Institute at UAMS. He is an internationally recognized scientist, clinician in the field of molecular genetics and blood cell cancers, and in particular, multiple myeloma. Now, he came to us from, University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences from the Royal Marsden Institute of the National Health Service Foundation Trust and the Institute of Cancer Research in London. And this happens to be Europe's largest and most comprehensive cancer institute, where he was a professor of hematology and a director of the Center for Myeloma Research. He received his doctorate in leukemia, actually in the genetics of leukemia, from the University of London in 1991, and his doctor's degree in 1981 from the Welsh National School of Medicine. He is the director of the Myeloma UK, a respected UK patient organization, which is much like the IMF, as well as a member of the scientific board of the IMF. He is founding director of the European Myeloma Network. Dr. Gordon has authored more than 450 articles appearing in leading peer journals, including the New England Journal of Medicine, Blood Journal, Clinical Oncology, Leukemia, Lancet Oncology, and Clinical Cancer Research. He is a member of the British Society of Hematology, the American Society of Hematology, the American Association for Cancer Research, the Royal College of Physicians, UK, and the Royal College of Pathologists in the UK. So my point would be is that for UAMS, he was quite a great get. So welcome to the program, Dr. Morgan.
Thank you, Gary, and thank you for that very overinflated introduction. But it's a real pleasure to be here in the U.S. and being in the University of Arkansas. It's a kind of honor, and I should say I'm really enjoying it, and I'm looking forward to some interesting conversation and questions and discussion this afternoon.
Well, given your background, as I see it, you come from London, right, which is like a European capital, has all the best of the best. You headed one of the most prestigious institutions in the world for multiple myeloma, and you're going to UAMS, which is in Little Rock, not the capital of much. And in addition, I would say that, if anything, it's been a topic of much conversation. What were you thinking?
So I was actually thinking very creatively, and it was kind of good moment for me. I don't think it was a bad decision. In fact, I think it was a good decision for me, and I think a good decision for the program in MERT. I think the access to patients and the infrastructure that we have in Little Rock is amazing for myeloma patients, and we have people that look after all aspects of the myeloma patient's experience, from kind of greeting them on arrival, looking after their pastoral care, to getting them educated in myeloma, to delivering the treatment, again, predominantly as an outpatient. And given that we're the largest myeloma center in the world, that having access to that group of patients and the facilities here will allow us to really deliver game-changing treatments for patients with myeloma. And we are entering a...
Excellent to learn. I just think giving up all that, you know, is just remarkable on your part. So you must be saying something that, you know, just the standard individual may not observe, you know.
Yeah, I'm enthusiastic about it. We have things here, and we have a team of dedicated people that really put themselves out for myeloma patients. And I think we can, take things to the next level, really.
Okay, great. Well, one thing I wanted to let you know for full disclosure is that you've got two people that were both treated at UAMS, myself and Nick Van Dyke, And Nick happens to be, you know, very, very close with Bart, and I like Bart as well. But I don't quite have the bromance that Nick has with Bart. But I'll try to be as objective as I possibly can, but I'm not, because
okay.
I think you guys have done a wonderful job, and I think I'm here 8.5 years later after having dialysis-dependent kidney failure, so I feel blessed to be here. Dr. Morgan, UMS has been known as the Morkin Cure facility with exceptional survival results. Could you explain the total therapy program for us and why it has such success?
So I'm going to start answering that question by just explaining a little bit about the background of myeloma. So I think we're very clear now that within myeloma, there's more than one cancer cell or one clone. So it's not homogeneous. There are cells within the cancer itself that have different behaviors. And the challenge has been to kill all of those cells so that there are no cells left to lead to relapse and failure of treatment. And that's where the more can cure comes into it. I'm not sure I kind of would portray it as more can cure. I would say that combination treatments of drugs with different modes of action allow you to kill more of these cells and therefore cure more patients. And what's kind of happening really is the whole program is moving from, you know, this more chemotherapy, more dose-intense chemotherapy can cure, to more one of, rather than total therapy, I'm kind of thinking of it more as total targeted therapy, where we look at the patient's myeloma using the gene array sequencing, you know, all of the biological tests that we can bring to bear, understanding what is happening with that patient's cancer, and then choosing the most appropriate treatment for those patients. And this involves not just the chemotherapy, it involves using antibody treatments, targeted therapies, and largely what we're aiming to do is to move away from a one-size-fits-all heavy chemotherapy approach to a more directed, well-thought-through, innovative, personalized approach.
Not once did I hear you say transplant. Is that something that you're shying away from, or is it still an integral part of the program?
Transplant remains one of the major tools that we have for the treatment of myeloma. And for the majority of younger, fitter patients, I think we can use transplant as the backbone of our treatment, but improve outcomes by adding in novel agents, antibodies, and targeted treatments.
Does that include dual transplant?
Yeah, I was going to say, so at this point in time, I don't want to move away from the high cure rates we've got just to try new treatments. So we need to work on a strategy that probably allows us to remove one of the transplants so that we move to a less dose-intense treatment, but more treatment overall, so that we not only maintain our high cure rates, but move to even higher and better responses. And I think this is possible. But what we don't want to do is take a step backwards by moving away from a strategy that we know to be successful.
You said monoclonal antibodies. That's currently not in the program. So is that something you're looking to?
Yeah, very, very much. So one of the most exciting things has been the development of antibodies that work in myeloma. And the kind of molecule on the cell surface called CD38, there are now antibodies that recognize CD38, so anti-CD38 monoclonal antibodies. And they're getting responses in relapsed refractory disease better than we've seen with any of the other drugs. And our aim is to move them to the front line into our total targeted treatment approach that will get the benefit of cures immediately for those patients. So we're starting to plan trials for doing that now, which I think is a very innovative new direction for the program, as well as to build not just single monoclonal antibodies, but to build combinations that move us away from chemotherapy totally in some respects. But I'm very cautious about people's long-term health and their survival. So we don't want to kind of deny people excellent treatment. So we'll do this cautiously, but it looks like a major step forward, I think, in the program, and will improve outcomes considerably.
The program has provided great success, and you've had an opportunity to look under the covers there and see the numbers and all that stuff. And from your assessment, you would say that that is in fact true. But are these, unless it's not, I assume you say it is, but are these, are there downsides to quality of life?
Yeah, so you should let me answer that question because.
That first question. Okay.
Yeah, I kind of looked at the data here, and the patients that are in the studies have been entered into the studies up front. The data's been collected well. We have external committees that review responses and survival. That is a kind of committee of people from the NCI, and we have the results are as they're presented. We have excellent 15 years and beyond survival rates, which I think you can equate to cure in this disease. So
that's remarkable. That's fantastic.
No, it is really. And the other thing that I would say, which you find when you come to a new organization, is what are the quality of the people like here? Well, I would say without shadow of a doubt that I've inherited a collection of dedicated professionals that do their job really well and understand their business and deliver it in a professional manner. So that's been a great discovery for me. It makes my job so much easier, and I think I can concentrate on getting advances to patients as quickly as we can, which is our aim for everybody.
And looking at the data, do you see downsides in the quality of life, secondary cancers, MDS, or any other complications which come with this more intense therapy?
So when you're having chemotherapy, it clearly affects your quality of life. And there is kind of a period of time where your quality of life is impaired. People have to stay in Little Rock. It's not such a bad place. It's a nice place. But during that time, you have to
suffer. I agree. I'm sorry.
but the issue is it's a trade-off. It's like, so what you're trading off is some time at the beginning of your disease, during which you have to accept being a patient. But once you're through that period of time, then you've got a 60% chance of being alive, cured well, at beyond 10 years. And that's a really important trade-off. And I think it's one that people should accept because the benefits of being away from doctors for prolonged periods of time, just having follow-up, going back to a normal quality of life, back to your family, is a really major endpoint. I mean, I get the concept of cure, and I want to cure as many people as possible, but quality of life, family life, and time with your family is really important to everybody. And I think we give people quality family time and survival when they're well. So I don't think there's a downside on quality of life. The issue about MDS, I kind of looked at our figures for MDS here, and I'm not convinced that there's a problem with long-term secondary cancers or myelodysplasia. I think it was an issue. Giving anybody chemotherapy and IMiD drugs together can be an issue, but I think the benefits far outweigh the minimal chances that there are of developing MDS at 10 years and beyond. When you think of what we were offering people in the past, which was 2.5 years of survival and little else, I think it's dramatic success for the program and for patients with myeloma.
Thank you, Doctor. Well, I think you've answered my next question, which I won't ask then. But UMS had participated in clinical trials, but they are generally UMS-only trials. And they seldom, you see little participation from other institutions. Will this continue to be the modus operandi, or will you now participate in some of the national trials, like monoclonal antibodies, et cetera?
We've always been a part of national trials. Bart was a member of SWOG, and we've contributed to SWOG studies. We just completed a SWOG study of smoldering multiple myeloma. So we will continue to participate with that group, and I have no problem in saying that whatsoever. Our real aim here is to bring innovative treatment strategies to patients as soon as we feasibly can. And for that reason, we have our own internal trial setup in which we recruit people to, which gives us that facility really to kind of really push at the cutting edge of treatment and bring this to patients early on. And what we're looking for are major changes in treatment now, not nuancing 2-3% improvement overall. I think there's treatments out there, and we need to find the major new therapies that have big effects and then to bring them to patients as soon as possible. And I've told you about where we're going with monoclonal antibodies, and that's a good example of how we want to get them into the front line so we can improve cure rates further rather than going to end-stage disease and looking for effects.
I guess one of the questions, too, would be, why aren't other people jumping on this bandwagon? You know, why aren't Total Therapy 3 and 4 trials being used in other institutions? You know, because they're national, aren't they? Or are they UMS only?
I can't answer for the rest of the U.S. We bring people in from around the world who go on to these treatment protocols. They do well. And I think there's been a coming together of strategies, and you would be surprised how influential this Total Therapy program has been. But the concepts implicit in it of induction, transplant 1, transplant 2, consolidation and maintenance, and now the basis for treatment around the country and around the world, and certainly in the UK, I was using these approaches for patients there, and we get good approaches in the UK. I think, you know, we have quality staff here as well, and I think, you know, we do a good job by patients. One of the interesting things I think is that patients with low-risk myeloma are doing very well, but there's 10 to 20% of myeloma that you can see with the gene array that we use that have very poor outcomes, where we haven't really been improving therapy for patients for the last decade, really. And what we want to do is have a focus on those patients, really trying to evaluate therapies for these guys and then translate the advances made by kind of trying to improve the outcome of high-risk disease for all patients with myeloma. And I think that's really the other main thrust and change of where we're going is how do we really change the outcome of what is, you know, a disease, much like myeloma was 15 years ago with 2 years on average survival, that we need to push out and really get to curing this group of patients as well. So that's going to be a major interest here.
Yeah, Doctor, one thing I wanted to say about you is that I've already seen that you've done a number of things since you've been here. You've been on the Myeloma Crowd website your talk. They have one. You're on this one. You were on Patient Power. You had a myeloma blog. You had a number of other papers. And it seems like you're getting out in front of a lot of people and explaining your program and that type of thing. And I think that has a lot to do with my next question, which is that, it's everybody has an opinion about UAMS. And that opinion is usually if you're somebody who has gone there, you know, you think that it's God's gift to patients. And if you haven't gone there, then it seems to be open for significant criticism. And it's either one or the other. There doesn't seem to be a whole heck of a lot in between. It's kind of it's an image issue, but it's really not an image issue. It's an image conundrum because everybody has an opinion, you know, and it's either one or the other. So my question is you know, you get it's a lightning rod of discussion on all of the, you know, social media pages, both praise, scathing criticism, and some things in between. What are your now that you've just arrived, what are your purely objective observations of the reasons for such varied views of the program?
That's a really hard question, and it's difficult for me to talk about the past. I think you make a good observation. I'm clearly trying to communicate with patients from around America and the world. And I want them to understand that we are a kind of cutting-edge, innovative center where we look after the pastoral care of patients, make them feel welcome, and we deliver the most appropriate treatment for that patient, be it aggressive chemotherapy or be it monoclonal antibody therapy or targeted treatment. And we won't shoehorn them all into a one-size-fits-all box. So in one level, I want to bring us more to the midline, but I'd like us to remain cutting edge in delivering the best of as many people as we can, because I think we do get good results, and I think that's something to be proud of.
Well, thank you very much, Doctor, and continue on all your efforts to explain the program and find a way to cut through some of this bad information. At least I think it's bad information. But then again, I said I'm 8.5 years continuous remission, so I'm a little partial to the program. Now, let's get on to the other questions. Pat Killingsworth, your question.
Thanks, Gary, and thanks for being here, Doctor.
No problem.
I understand that, it's the lead-in has included a lot of attention to total therapy, but I'm sure that the Institute spends a great deal of time and money and effort trying to keep late-stage myeloma patients alive, too. So could you take some time and explain to us some of the innovative therapies that your team has come up with to try to keep some of us alive, those of us like Gary? I'm approaching 8 years, but unlike Gary, I have now relapsed 3 times, and eventually you run out of standard options. Could you enlighten us, please?
So I think the antibody approach is something I've talked about, which is clearly really appropriate for people with relapsed disease, and building combinations of antibodies that fix different components of the immune system is going to be a really important way forward. There's antibody SLAM-F7, which combines beautifully with Revlimid. There is the anti-CD38 antibodies, of which there are 3 that will come into clinical use. There are antibodies called anti-PD-1 and anti-PD-L1, which seem to enhance the immune system in the presence of other antibodies, and also there are antibodies which enhance the activity of cells called natural killer cells, which gobble up the myeloma cells and put people into remission. So we have a kind of program that we'll put into place along those directions, together with taking cells that are expanded in the laboratory and reinfused into patients. The latter option is more experimental, and the single and combination antibodies are more kind of relevant to patients at the current time. The really kind of cool thing is that I've been interested in doing sequencing the cancer cells from myeloma patients, and we found a mutation called BRAF that's a member of the RAS family. And so BRAF is mutated in 4% of cases at presentation, maybe 10% at relapse, and RAS is mutated in about 50% of cases. So we took a BRAF inhibitor and gave it to a BRAF mutated patient, and that patient went into a response. No toxicity, kind of went into a remission over a 7-day period and managed to stay in response even though they had every prior chemotherapy for 6 months. So maybe that's not, you know, the duration of time wasn't good, but the fact you could show you could get a remission even in heavily treated patients is really, really relevant. So now we're sequencing people regularly for RAS, and we have a RAS inhibitor, or it's a downstream inhibitor of RAS called Mekinist. And if a patient has a RAS mutation signature, we will treat that patient with the Mekinist, and we get responses again, even where we wouldn't have expected them in the past. And so we're trying to build on that targeted treatment strategy by fully evaluating the Mekinist in a standardized fashion and then building combinations that enhance its activity. And this is an entirely non-chemotherapy approach. But you can imagine when you build it in with chemotherapy that our results will be even better. So I think it's a fascinating time, and I think these targeted treatments will become more and more relevant.
Well, that's very exciting. Now, the RAS mutation patients, is this a form of resensitization? The drugs that weren't working anymore now work, or is this a completely different mechanism?
Totally new. So Mekinist was developed for melanoma, a skin cancer, and it turns out that I think the RAS pathway is more mutated in myeloma, and so myeloma seems to be a disease where we can explore all of these RAS inhibitors and expect to see responses. And it's not got much airtime really in the myeloma community, but I think after ASH time, it's going to become more and more out there with more and more people discussing it, because it is a significant way forward.
Great. Are you working with the MMRF on that? Because if I'm not mistaken, I was having a conversation like this with several folks over there about this, and it does sound really exciting.
So I think a patient from, I can't even remember where it is, so in the northeast, Wilmington, attended, was connected into the MMRF, and we treated that patient with the Mekinist, and they responded. And so it's been, I think it is exciting, and yeah, of course, we're collaborating with anybody that's in the myeloma community that wants to kind of push the outcome of myeloma patients forward. And, you know, it's a community effort, not just a single institution effort.
Well, thank you for all of your hard work and efforts, and that's very encouraging. Thank you, Doctor.
Yeah, thanks, Nick.
Thank you, Ben.
Pat,
Nick
sorry.
Van Dyke, are you on air?
I am. Can you hear me?
You bet.
Yeah, I can.
Hey, Doctor, it's very nice to meet you telephonically. As Gary mentioned, I'm a patient and, dare I say, a friend of your motorcycling colleague, and I was treated there in 2009 under Total Therapy for Light, and I remain in stringent complete remission. I'm MRD negative, and I'm extremely thankful for my treatment there. So I'm also a partisan. And I'm sort of infamous on these calls for having long questions, but I've got one for you, which is, if we think about standard risk myeloma, there's been a debate that has posed the question, well, we know transplants and novel agents together work well, but what if novel agents do just as well by themselves? And you referred to some subtle changes to the total therapy approach, even mentioning you might move away in some cases from tandems, you know, because we all know there's nothing magical about tandems, it's just twice the melphalan. And the work of Dr. Tiedemann in Toronto has shown, at least that in vitro, the progenitor cells don't have the structures required to make them susceptible to IMIDs and proteasome inhibitors. It takes alkaliders to actually uproot those progenitor cells and kill them. And if we're closer to home than Toronto, if we look in Little Rock, the recent article in Blood that showed TT4 standard versus TT4 light, the standard arm is doing a lot better, and the only difference is the standard arm got more of the alkylators. So with all that, is it your opinion that novel agents alone can do the job, or does it still take the hardcore chemo for a lot of this stuff? And where do the new immunotherapies and antibody therapies come into it? Do the progenitor cells exhibit CD138, or is this another exercise in killing the weeds on top of the lawn but not getting to the roots?
Nick, you're right. You ask long questions, but it's very, very good question. So, like, if I start with TT4 standard versus TT4 light, I think the standard arm did do better, and I think that answers your point, that we should be very careful about moving away from alkylators too quickly and relying exclusively on novel agents. And at one level, we should be building on the successes with alkylators using novel drugs. So the CD38 is expressed on a myeloma precursor, and so I would expect that antibody to be successful. And so we're definitely not going to drop our successes and aim for transplant-free approaches. There's been a study recently from Antonio Palumbo, which compared transplants versus non-transplant with the same agents other than the transplant, and the transplant arm stayed in remission longer and lived longer. So transplants do work, and we need to be very, very careful about dropping them. There's a kind of, I think for patients, to say dropping transplants makes no sense and could set us back. I think we need to move towards, you know, not doing a transplant when we're sure how the novel agents really do work. One thing's for clear, you should never see peritransplant mortality. We shouldn't be killing patients with chemotherapy. That's counterintuitive at so many levels. And we should always remember that each patient is different, and doing transplantation in frail patients is nonsense, and we should move towards using antibodies and novel agents. So beneath that level,
No, I was just going to say that makes perfect sense. I had one slightly shorter follow-up, which is near and dear to me.
Finish off on the
Oh, please, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off.
The deal with Roger is he's my pal, but that piece of work is not my most favored piece of work, and at many levels I don't believe it. Not that I think he's cheating at any level, but the results are difficult for me to understand. And I think we can target treatment to the biology of the myeloma stem cell, which looks a lot like a myeloma plasma cell. And I think it's been shown reasonably conclusively that the myeloma cell itself is the target for treatment. And so overall, I think we have a number of ways forward which are based around targeting with what we see on the myeloma cell itself. But they seem to exist in this dynamic relationship with a smaller population of cells that don't have so much 138 on their cell surface. And those cells might be epigenetically different to the mature non-myeloma stem cells. And I think that we're aiming to try and understand that population and to target epigenetic drugs like that affect histone methylation, DNA methylation, in order to make those cells more susceptible to chemotherapy. And I think that's, a feasible approach. But I guess the definite answer to your question is, for now, we shouldn't move away from alkylating agents totally, but we should build on our successes. Ask your next question.
Gotcha. Okay, so thank you. So given that more people are achieving stringent complete remission and that MRD testing is becoming more widespread, it's both generally useful to patients and then also as someone who's still MRD negative but facing the declining remission curve in the light arm, are there other tests beyond random MRD and marrow that can be done to assess outcome, like deep sequencing or heavy light assays, or even, you know, Bart likes to look for full resolution of focal lesions under MRI. Are you seeing other types of tests that could be useful to corroborate how durable MRD negativity might be?
The important question for you and for patients is, what was the sensitivity of the test that was used to detect your MRD? Because it varies from center to center, and you really need a test that's sensitive to one tumor cell in a million normal cells. And so if we can get people to below that level of tumor cells, I think we'll then start to see the flow cytometry turning into a really clinically relevant predictive test. And there's other ways of doing it. And deep down, I think that the flow cytometry is very difficult to standardize across a country as big as the US. And what we're kind of thinking is that the molecular PCR-based testing for MRD, which is called ASO-PCR or Sequenta or Sequenta technology, call it, is more routinely applicable, more sensitive, and I actually think that we'll be moving towards PCR-based assessment of MRD rather than flow cytometry. So that's my bias in the argument. But both tests are good, but you should always ask what was the sensitivity of the test, because if it's only sensitive to one tumor cell in 10 normal cells, you could have quite a lot of disease on board. And it's good advice.
Wonderful. Any idea when PCR MRD tests might be put in place at Merck?
Early in the new year, we can do them now, and we're kind of collecting up all of the samples that we have to get analyzed. And so I'm pretty confident that early next year we'll have all of this stuff. We'll have the data and we'll have the capacity to do it on patients coming for follow-up. Because following up patients is really important. And, you know, basically, Bart has always done a good job of kind of developing and applying tests to predict relapse. And so we're also working on a sort of cure signature, which I think could be really helpful. If we could look at people and say the immune cells in their marrow have returned to normal, the marrow structure is normal on gene expression, then, you know, I think that would be really reassuring to to patients. And I think you should be reassured. I kind of think where you are is you're doing good. You're not facing the outcome of having an inferior treatment. I think you did well on it. And I hope it continues that way.
Thank you. Well, my hip and I will be there in January, and you can have some marrow. Thank you very much.
All right. Is Cindy, and I know she was having difficulty flying out. Did she make it on the line? Cindy, are you online?
Not with us.
Okay. She has some travel troubles, so I'll ask her question for her. Cindy asks, I recently read your article on evolution and intraclonal heterogeneity in myeloma. You suggested that in general, Darwinian evolutionary concepts suggest that single drug exposure may not be the best approach to treating myeloma, as it may lead to the outgrowth of resistant clones, and resistant clones could be overcome by either using combinations of different drugs or using cyclic approaches that employ different combinations of drugs at different times in an alternating fashion. Do you know if someone has used or plans to use the cyclical approach during maintenance? To me, this approach may make sense, especially if a combination therapy was used during induction and consolidation.
So I agree with Cindy. I kind of think it needs to be done, and it does make sense. And so one of the kind of steps we're going to do is we've been using Velcade and Revlimid for maintenance, and we plan to compare that in a randomized fashion to cyclic use of the different drugs and introduce the antibody and maybe histone deacetylase inhibitors to build a combination regimen for maintenance. And it does make sense, and as long as we don't increase toxicity, I think it's likely to be successful. Of course, we don't know the answer to that, which is why we'd have to kind of set about doing a randomized comparison. But if you build these randomized comparisons with novel endpoints such as MRD detection and functional imaging such as PET and MRI, I think you start to see a way forward of evaluating different approaches at the 1 and 2 year time point rather than having to wait for 10 years to really get an answer.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Doctor. What we'll do now is we'll go to some of the questions from our listeners. And Priya, could you bring on anybody online right now? If not, I'll go to the submitted questions.
Listeners, if you have a question for Dr. Morgan, please press 1 on your keypad and we can bring you on air to ask your question live. We have a caller calling in from 917685. You are on air. Please ask your question.
Yes, hi. Good afternoon, Dr. Morgan. Thank you for taking my call. This is Dana Holmes, and I'm a smoldering multiple myeloma patient. Based upon percentage of plasma cells and flow cytometry, I don't have any CRAB or any of the myeloma-defining events per the new International Myeloma Working Group guidelines. I'm curious to know your approach regarding early treatment intervention for smoldering patients. Will your group develop any trials, or will you offer existing trials to your smoldering patients before the disease likely becomes more complex as the disease progresses? What are your feelings about treating smoldering patients?
So my inclination, based on the behavior of smoldering myeloma and other cancers, is to treat before patients develop the end organ damage. I think it's a kind of truism for all cancer that if you treat early, you get better outcomes. So conceptually, that's where I am. The issue with smoldering myeloma is that it's not one kind of condition in a way. It's a spectrum of disease. And at one end, you have muggus, which is entirely benign, and the time to change into myeloma is very, very prolonged, and I think there's no indication for therapeutic intervention. And the high-risk smoldering myeloma, which is a lot like early myeloma, which is going to change to myeloma within a year and a half. And so what we've been basing our strategy around is using the gene arrays to predict which of the patients will transform within a two-year period. And so we now have a signature, a four-gene signature that predicts with high certainty patients at high risk of progression. And we've kind of written the paper, we're putting it in the post. But I think we have a way now that's more accurate than flow cytometry. It's more accurate than using the light chain ratio and does, you know, predict people at high risk. And so what we were going to do is to offer people with high-risk disease access to the anti-CD38 antibody treatment, which doesn't damage the body. It's targeted to the tumor cells. And I think we're likely to see really good outcomes with such an approach. We don't have it up and running yet, but that's our plan for the new year.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Morgan. Now, the four-gene signature through your it would be through gene expression profiling. Is that offered outside of MIRT? Can a patient that is not with your group get that actual test?
There's a commercial laboratory, Signal Genetics, that people can have their doctor send the test to that company. And so, yeah, the answer to your question is yes, it is. Not many people take it up, though. And so I don't really understand that. I think the gene expression arrays actually give a lot of information, and I think it's pertinent to smoldering myeloma and to myeloma at presentation.
Okay, very good. Thank you so much. And you said anti-CD38 or 138?
38.
Okay, very good. Thank you so much, Dr. Morgan, for taking my call. Appreciate it.
I'll talk to you.
Thank you, Dana. Priya, next question.
Gary, I think we can go over the submitted questions.
Okay. All right. So we've got one question from one of our members who couldn't make it, and that was Jack Aiello. And Jack saw you in Houston, and Jack says that in Houston, he thought you said that you can or need to do better than FISH, cytogenetics and GEP, genetic expression profiling, to learn more about an individual's myeloma and which treatment might work best for them. If Jack didn't mishear you, which is certainly possible, can you talk more about this, or instead can you clarify where we are in using these techniques to develop precision medicine?
The issue with FISH is that a lot of people get told they have high-risk disease because they have certain FISH lesions. And the bottom line is that with any FISH group, some have high-risk and some have low-risk. And the only way to sort that out is really using the gene expression signatures. And so that's the most accurate way that I can see currently of defining if you're high risk or low risk. And like I said before, about 20% of people are high risk and need to kind of explore novel treatments and novel approaches. The patients with low risk can be confident of good outcomes and long-term survival. The challenge is that even within low risk, there are maybe 7 different groups, and some of them benefit from certain treatments and others from other treatment. And what we're trying to explore is ways of customizing treatment for each one of those seven different groups. And, you know, there are possibilities of using antibodies to CD20, for instance. So CD20 is only expressed in one of the groups. And in certain patients we've seen, we've given them anti-CD20 antibodies and they've responded. Some groups take longer to respond than others. So if you're not in a remission at 3 months, it's important to know which group you belong to, because one of the groups that doesn't get a good remission actually get better remissions at 3 years and do well long-term, do extremely well. So you don't want to be over-treating patients. And so the next decade is going to be all about understanding the biology of the tumor, its clinical behavior, and how to intervene in a personalized fashion.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Sherry asks, can Total Therapy work for those with kidneys affected by MM? And does it work well enough to recover kidney function or either to enable someone to receive a kidney transplant?
So the time to prevent kidney damage is when you first see the patient. So it's important to get in, start treatment, and the sooner you reduce the paraprotein and the light chain values, the you improve the chances of recovery of the kidney function. So, yes, you can improve kidney function. If it's fixed and you've had it for a long time, I think that becomes difficult to improve. I forgot the other part of the question.
Or enough to enable someone to receive a transplant.
Yeah, so I think you can take account of the kidney function in the dose that you select for transplant. And so if you have a good renal doctor as part of your unit and you discuss with them, it's possible to adjust the dose and still to get good outcomes and to really improve the outcomes for people with renal disease. It's a recurrent problem and it's something we have experience with.
Okay, Kate asks, following the Darwin ICH theory, if combination of drugs has led to more effective treatments of myelomas involving invariable cells, does it follow that maintenance therapies should also be combinations of drugs?
Yeah, kind of. We try to learn from infectious diseases. And, you know, in treating bacterial infections, if people have chronic lung disease with recurrent infections, you don't put them on one antibiotic and expect it to work forever. You change between three different antibiotics, say. So I think that's a good paradigm for what we're trying to do for myeloma patients when you've got them into complete remissions. The idea is you keep the pressure on those cells so they're continually being threatened with death till eventually you kill the last one and then the patient doesn't relapse. And so we're not there yet totally with understanding that process. But these sensitive tests that allow you to look at small numbers of cells is going to allow us to answer that question.
Eric asks, what tests are most useful either at 2 years post-transplant or at relapse?
So at 2 years post-transplant, it's important to look in the bone marrow looking for no detectable tumor cells. And the flow cytometry and the PCR is the most sensitive way of doing that. You want to know that the patient doesn't have focal lesions in the bone marrow, their blood work is good, and if all of those are negative, then things are looking great. relapse, you need to reassess the whole disease, re-image, MRI, diffusion-weighted MRI, PET-CT scans, gene expression array to check the biological behavior of the disease, and pretty soon it's going to involve sequencing, looking for mutations that can be targeted.
Okay, here's a kind of an interesting one. How feasible is maintaining stable disease, light chain only, under 100 milligrams per liter, or low M spike and no CRAB symptoms with maintenance therapy?
So,
no, I guess just maintenance therapy in general, no transplant, no induction.
So say you're in a remission after your treatment and you have those conditions. The important thing is not to over-treat. People with those diseases or that disease description can remain stable for years and years and years, and I think maintenance can help control it at that level, even if it totally doesn't eradicate the last cell. I mean, you can consider that patients of having achieved a Mugger's-like state that is essentially benign and stable. And what you're trying to do is prevent it transforming again to something more aggressive. And so you don't want to, like, over-treat patients, give them symptoms, impair their quality of life just because they haven't got a complete response. And that's a kind of important value judgment to be made.
Okay, and Kate had another question. At this time, what are the most hopeful trials for high-risk patients?
So I think the targeted treatments, and I think the introduction of antibodies in the background of chemotherapy is really the most hopeful. I think they're going to push the outcome out, and I think these new antibodies may totally change our paradigm about who's good risk, who's bad risk, and that's one of the questions that we really wish to address, because, you know, one level you could argue that chemotherapy could make high-risk disease progress quicker, and using the antibodies, if they're effective and they downgrade the behavior of the disease, I think that may be a very exciting way forward.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I had one last question, and if you would be so kind. I know in Europe you have the NHS, National Health Service, and it has some of the best data, the most robust data for myeloma, and noted that 1 in 5 patients die in the first 2 months of after diagnosis, and that only 3% of the population in the UK has ever heard of myeloma. How do we change this to get improved awareness and early diagnosis? Because we're no different in the U.S. Most everybody that I've ever talked to with myeloma said that when they learned about it is when they were told they had it.
So it's a bit of a scandal, really. The average time to diagnosis is 3 to 6 months, and more often than not, it's 6 months. And you hear these harrowing stories of people driving around in their cars with backaches, you know, going over road bumps and being in agony. And to make real inroads into myeloma, we need to get it diagnosed earlier, and making family practitioners and family doctors more aware of the condition, and to do a kind of M spike and light chain value on patients makes a lot of sense to me. I think, you know, the other kind of tragedy is when somebody develops renal failure, because they didn't develop that overnight. That will have been present for months and months beforehand. And it's just a case of thinking myeloma, do the M spike and the light chain values, and refer early on for good treatment and expert advice. it's really important to get a myeloma expert on your side, even if it's only for a, you know, an initial consultation. I think the value long term is important.
It's one of the most misdiagnosed things. We had somebody here in Jacksonville who was being treated for psoriasis and then finally found out that he had myeloma, but too late to save him.
Yeah, no, it's a tragedy. And, you know, that would have been something that was there for a prolonged period of time as well, because it's a disease that doesn't come on overnight. You know, it's many years in the making.
Well, I know that, you know, we have programs that try to do, you know, to do just that, but obviously we haven't made much of an impact yet. So, you know, I
it's
certainly
like,
would
I think
love
patient organizations like this can make a difference. It's about all about patient empowerment and understanding the disease, what they went through, and making it obvious to healthcare professionals that this is something that needs to be thought about. And another kind of really interesting kind of area that needs to be thought about is, if you have MUGUS, what do you do about that? Are there ways that we could investigate MUGUS and give non-toxic treatment in a sort of chemo prevention fashion to prevent it turning into smoldering myeloma and then to myeloma? And I think, you know, we're just touching on that now. We're treating, you know, high-risk smoldering myeloma. But the obvious place to go is to go earlier, and you need totally safe treatments for that kind of study. But I think that's where we'll get to eventually, chemo prevention strategies, early diagnosis, regular screening for a paraprotein, and intervention years before there are any symptoms or signs. That's futuristic now, but it's something we should aim for.
Well, thank you so much, and I'd love to see that. I think everybody would like to have enough time to do the research, become their own advocate, find a myeloma specialist to give themselves, you know, like you say, 14 years, right, at UAMS versus the 4 years as reported by, you know, the SEER data. So that extra 10 years times, you know, times 20,000 people a year, you know, it turns into a lot of life.
Yeah, for sure.
So, Doctor, thank you so much. Priya, any other questions from our callers?
We have a quick question from one of the callers. Person calling in from 813-997, please ask your question.
Yes. I'm one of Dr. Bartolgi's precious ones. I'm a 23-year survivor, but I've relapsed twice. And so my question is that the last time I was treated with Velcade, and fortunately went into remission again, but my treatment extended Velcade extended 2 years beyond the time I went into remission, actually until my bone lesions healed. Well, I live in Tampa and near Moffitt, and I have friends that get treated with myeloma there, and the doctors there, kind of terminate therapy as soon as the person goes into remission. So I'm wondering about the length of treatment and what your thoughts are.
God forbid I'd say anything about the doctors at Moffitt, who are obviously good. However, my approach, Bart's approach, and I think an approach kind of justified by the evidence, is if you stop treating with Velcade too early, people relapse. And there is Revlimid, Thalidomide, and Velcade, the prolonged treatment gives better outcomes. And I think that's a kind of attitude that's extending around the world, and there's plenty of evidence to support it. And that's why I think that I say the total therapy approach of prolonged maintenance and exposure to drugs is becoming more generally accepted and has in fact become the global standard.
Thank you, Doctor. Dr. Morgan, thank you so very much. It has been wonderful listening to you. And thank you very much for your time. Gary, Pat, and Nick, thank you very much. Please join us again on 17th of December at 5 p.m. Eastern Time for our next Myeloma broadcast, where we will be discussing ASH 2014 Myeloma Update with Dr. Parameswaran Hari. The link for today's broadcast will be shared with all the participants. Please visit curetalks.com to register for our shows. Until then, thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Morgan. You
did
a wonderful job.
Thank you for listening to me, and thanks for asking good questions and bearing with me.